Hello, and welcome to State of Our Workforce. My name is Michelle Wilson, and I am the Director of Evaluation and Learning at the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. Each month on State of Our Workforce, we take a journey into the heart of workforce innovation and explore how to build an equitable workforce. This month, I'm excited to be in conversation with Chike Agu, a senior advisor for the Project on Workforce at Harvard University, where his research and work focuses on the future of work, economic mobility, and job quality, among many other things. On this episode, Chike and I will dig into what he calls the arc and explore how we can continue the work of building an inclusive and equitable economy. Good morning, Chike. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I am super excited to have you here with us today. I want to start my question for you, because I've been looking on your Harvard page and just doing deep background, looking at all your stuff and looking at how amazing your work is. And so for me, when I look through your work, the question for me is that you've worked at the intersection of technology, education, and workforce development for years. And so I'm curious about what first drew you into this space and what keeps you engaged today. And I also offer that as a way, again, for you to do your own bio around what stands out for you.
Sure. First of all, Michelle and to the National Fund, just thank you, everyone, for having me. But secondly, thank you for having this space to have these types of conversations. I think right now, particularly in the environment that we're in, we need more of these types of spaces. So I just thank you for what you all are doing with me right now, but also kind of what you all have done and the great work that you continue to do every single day. Why do I care about this work, this kind of intersection? And if I were to describe kind of my work, or ideally where I am working, I see it as like a three circle Venn diagram. There's this circle around the future of work, which is everything around skills and how they create economic opportunity. There's the second circle around innovation, particularly these emerging technologies that are going to change the world and already are in ways that we know and don't know. And then there is this third circle around economic opportunity broadly, which is frankly, how do I do better than my parents did? Particularly in terms of being able to feed and sustain myself and my future family. Why do I care about this intersection? And it's very biographical. I think there's a great quote from President Clinton, which is, we are all prisoners of biography. And I'm very much that. My family is a very classic immigrant story of this country. My family's from Nigeria, from a far and out of the way village in that country that most Nigerians themselves will never go to and never visit, never see. My grandparents were all from the same village. None of them went past middle school. My parents were born on streets that were unpaved then. They are unpaved now. They have Peace Corps volunteers in their classrooms. And what changed life for them was they both got golden tickets in the mid-70s and early 80s to come to the United States of America and go to school. And they were supposed to actually go back home, but there was a military change of government and they never did. And so they had me and my siblings here in the United States. And I'm the first person in the entire history of my family born in this country. And, you know, I got to serve an American president. And so when you think about that journey, that shows that America can get it right. It shows that what we can do in the space of a generation. But what we also know is that doesn't, by statistics, we all can look at the data and use our own eyes. That doesn't happen in enough places for enough people enough of the time. And so I think for me, I've always felt, even from when I was a little kid, that me even being here was a bit unusual.
Yeah.
And what I've been obsessed with my entire life is, how do you replicate for others that which I've experienced by serendipity, by luck, forces bigger than me, but those forces are not systemic. And the question is, how do you turn the serendipity that allowed me to sit here and talk to you into systems that really help everybody, no matter who you are, what you look like, where you live? And so when I think about that, particularly now, particularly as I think about, let's say, a young man, a young woman like my mom came to this country, poor, immigrant, Black, how would they do again what they did before? And that answer sits at the intersection of the future of work, innovation, and economic opportunity.
Yeah. No, I so appreciate the backstory on that. And shout out to first generation. So are you a first generation college student as well?
No, so when I say first generation, no, I was really referring to the fact that I am the first person in the history of my family born in the United States. When my parents came here, they both got to go to, and it's why I'm so invested in public universities. My dad went to UT in Texas in Austin. My mom went to Rutgers in New Jersey, and I always say, particularly public universities, without which I would not be here. It's why I think we have to invest even more in them and invest in ways that are strategic and forward-looking. But I don't want to see a country without public universities that are built for the future.
Gotcha. That makes total sense. Okay, thanks for the clarification on that. So sorry. Yes. Your background and what keeps you in the game, I think, is a great segue into our first question about just thinking about the U.S. economy. And we had this conversation, and I appreciate how you talk about it and saying, like, I mean, it's true. The U.S. economy needs everybody, right? And so we aren't in a space where we can afford to let people sit on the sidelines. I'm a workforce. So talk to me more about that, because I know you're very passionate about this.
I think, Michelle, you're exactly right. We need everyone. If you look at the job openings per people looking nationally, 10 jobs open for every 9 people looking. In a state like mine in Maryland, 2 jobs open for every 1 person looking. Looking at specific sectors, healthcare, manufacturing, infrastructure, semiconductors, quantum, the ratios skyrocket. So, from a moral perspective, I think we all feel in our guts we want an economy that includes everybody, that makes room for everyone. And secondly, it's actually just a math problem. It's also, if you talk to business folk, it's a math problem, which is I have jobs that need to get filled, and I need to fill them with no matter who it is, with frankly, and no matter who it is. And what I've seen it lead to in industry for our leaders who are most forward-looking is I'm going to go to communities I've never gone to before, who never even heard of me or my industry before, and I'm going to have to figure out how I bring these folks into my company. And then one thing I always joke about, and I say this as a you know a, as a as an alum, doing another job fair in Harvard Yard is not going to fill your job postings. You already hired that person.
Yes.
All the folks at MIT and Stanford and all these other great, wonderful institutions, they already work for you, or they work for your competitor. You're going to have to go to places where no one's ever recruited before to fill all these jobs. And what I generally tell folks is that it should be as worth as much to you as an unfilled purchase order. There is something that you're not producing for a customer because you don't have the people, and you should know what that number is. And basically, one penny less than that should be what you're willing to spend to fill that job, you know, for with a person, no matter where they come from. So it's the right thing to do, and it's the smart thing to do, and it's lucky that they're the same thing.
And are you looking across the age spectrum? I mean, I know, I understand, I take your point, and I agree. Like looking in areas where you have not looked before. But I'm also thinking about just the economy, and as people age and people are retiring, not retiring, or staying longer in the workforce, are they looking? Is that an area that they're also looking at, or that they should be looking at as well too, like that?
The answer is a yes and yes, but we have to be precise about this. I think, and let's take both ends of the spectrum, because I think what you're seeing companies do, or realizing they should do, is you have to basically go more upstream and more downstream, meaning you have to get to young people younger than you ever have before. If you go to healthcare, which is in a crisis from a workforce perspective, they are talking about, can I get middle schoolers in for work-based learning into my hospitals? Because I don't have enough people. And by the way, I know, and they're willing to do that even knowing that they won't be able to do anything clinical for 4 or 5 years by law. They're just like, we're in such a tough circumstance that we know we have to go upstream, because if we don't do this now, we're not going to have people even a decade from now. Let's go to the other end, which is how do we get folks who have traditionally been older than the traditional workforce? And what we've seen is people use that part of the workforce. Gary Officer from the Center for Workforce Inclusion does amazing work on this. How do we use those workers in very precise ways? So let's take a really clear example. There's a huge explosion in work-based learning, apprenticeship, hire, train, deploy, pre-apprenticeship, basically where someone comes on site, maybe not through a formal program, and they learn on the job and they're paid for that service. One thing that a lot of companies are beginning to realize is not only do I need this incoming worker learning, I need some master worker teaching. And one of the things that they're realizing is, oh shoot, do I have a workforce built not just to work, but to teach? And when you look at a part of your workforce that actually might be really well suited for that, it's actually those folks who've been around for a while. And so you're beginning to see this happen. And to be honest, if you were to look at things like manufacturing, if you look at how a young worker learns on the line, they learn from for someone who's been on the line 10, 20, 30 years. And so I think the answer is yes, they should be. And you're beginning to see certain folks do that. Let me say one other thing, which is not a question that you asked, but I think it's one that's really important.
Sure.
What are these other populations that folks in the past have disregarded?
Yes, let's talk.
So I say this as I have two kids. They're right here. My son, Kalechi, he'll be 8 on St. Patrick's Day. He was diagnosed on the autism spectrum when he was 2 years old. And so what you're now beginning to see in really in the Fortune 1000 is a push toward including, you know, neurodiverse individuals into their workforce. One, because they need people. But two, you know, as I say, as the parent of a child on the spectrum, every child on the spectrum has a superpower. And what they're beginning to see, particularly in actually technical fields, is a couple things that pop out. One, you generally see a high level of what's called conscientiousness, meaning very detail oriented, more vastly more than a normal person, than a neurotraditional person,
right?
Which is hugely valuable. Secondly, what you'll find is higher than average, a quantitative superpower. They are better at math than a bunch of other folks. And so you're beginning to folks seeing, I'm not just doing this because it feels good or because I need bodies, but because for different parts of our population have potential superpowers that they can add to my organization. And what you're beginning to see, frankly, forced by circumstance, is we have to include everyone, not just because, again, bodies, but because they're bringing things to the table that we previously just never took into account and overlooked.
So what that says to me, TK, I mean, I love this conversation. And what that says to me, my mind is exploding thinking about what that sets up in terms of creating a workforce support system that is expansive enough to hold all of this, right? Because it's not a traditional way of doing it from HR perspective, and it feels like it's what needs to happen, but it also feels like overwhelming, right? In terms of how we get people on the same page, or how we build systems, like we should, and this is what we're working towards. But I think about that. And I'm curious, the challenge of that feels mind-numbing. It needs to be done, and we're doing it, and we have to, right? Like that, but it also feels like, oh, wow, who's looking at that? Who's tackling that piece of the puzzle? Do you know what I'm saying?
This is a massive challenge that just, it has to be solved the same way, you know.
We aren't talking about this part of it. We aren't talking about this part.
We are, I don't know if we are approaching it. And look, I worked in the Biden administration, was proud, so proudly did. So I worked for Julie Sue, who is my forever boss. That's what I call her. Yeah. If I were to have her here, she would talk exactly as you are talking in terms of the scale of the ambition. But the thing that I say, when I first joined the Biden administration and we were dealing with the pandemic, one phrase he would say a lot is, we're going to have a whole of government approach, which I think was right. Mm-hmm. I would generally take that a step further, which is to solve problems like this, you need a whole of society approach. Mm-hmm. Everybody from the government to the private sector to the nonprofit space has to be working on this and working in concert. What I generally find is not that people aren't working on this or talking about it. The issue is they're not talking in an integrated, strategic, collaborative mm-hmm. fashion, which is required. So I think you and I talked about this before. To me, I don't have all the answers, but I have the questions that you have to answer.
Sure. Right.
And everyone has a different piece of each question. So first question is, what is the work of the future? Just what is it?
Yeah.
Down to a skill level. And generally, when we've talked about jobs in the past, we have not been precise enough about the skills. And if I'm someone who wants to work in that job, I need to know what those are. If I'm an HR person hiring for that job, I need to know what they are. And I need to know, what does someone need to come in with? What am I willing to teach that person? What's first, second, third, so on and so forth. So, and this is where I think a lot of the really great data players could actually play a really unique and powerful role here. Because the challenge is, and we ran into this at the Department of Labor, the jobs are changing so fast. And even for the jobs that are still around, the underlying skills are changing that no human being can keep up with it. Just can't. I don't care if you're the Department of Labor, I don't care if you're labor statistics, I don't care if you're LinkedIn. It changes too fast. So that's one. What is the work of the future? Question two is, how do you train for that work? And what I say is, you need everything. You need everything from traditional 4-year degrees to 2-year degrees to short-term credentials to XR enabled virtual environments where folks are learning on the job to online curriculum and stuff we've not even invented. And the key is going to be that those are not going to be any single path. You're going to have a worker do all of that stuff over the course of their career to stay on top of the skills that they need to go where they want to go. Mm-hmm. Third question, which you don't talk enough about, how do the work and the worker find each other? We assume that if there's a job out there that I can do, then I'm just going to find it. Like they teach you in economics. That doesn't happen.
Right.
There are people who can do work. There are jobs that need that need those people, and they don't find each other. Byron from Opportunity at Work, who's a dear mentor of mine, he's talked about particularly how this affects Black workers. Mm-hmm. When you look at the workers who are most likely to not find the job to hit that meets their skills, they are Black and brown, they are women, they are immigrants, they are rural, and that hurts all of us. The fourth question is, how do you go from an economic, from a social safety net, which right now has a bunch of holes in it, from unemployment insurance to TANF to SNAP, to a true economic trampoline? Mm-hmm. Meaning a set of benefits that when you fall out of the labor market, you lose your job, you move, it catches you and it bounces you back into the labor market at least as well off as you were before. And the key thing that we pushed on a lot when I was at the Department of Labor is when someone gets that benefit, first of all, we don't get it to them fast enough. We don't get it to them in a way that's dignified or efficient, so on and so forth. That can't be the end of the conversation.
Right.
When, you know, I worked on unemployment insurance for 2.5 years. The question is, how do we go to a true reemployment system where when I stabilize you economically, which is what you need, I then say, what is it that you want to do next?
Right.
And the thing that we don't think about is we don't put like the psychology on it. You know, I had a colleague, Michelle Evermore, she used to say this all the time, and it was so true. The day someone files for unemployment insurance is the worst day of their life. Mm. And that's the day that we ask them to figure out their whole future career plan, all that, while they're trying to figure out how you're going to pay the rent, take care of your kids. We need a system that makes that far easier at that point. And my view was always, I used to joke about this, that we should not let someone leave an unemployment insurance office or a website without taking them through that to say, and now here's your roadmap for the next step.
Right.
Because most people who are on unemployment, they don't want to stay there. They don't. It doesn't feel great.
Yeah.
But how do we help them get to that next step? And then let me say one last thing, and then I'll get off. I'll put my soapbox over here.
Yeah, no, this is
good. The job quality piece. With the job quality piece, which is, how do we make sure that once someone is on the job, they are respected, protected, and dignified? And this is true for two reasons. One, because that's just what it should be. Two, because of the fact that because the American workforce is stagnant or shrinking, depending on how you look at the data, job retention is more important than ever. When I first came into the government for the first probably 18 months from January of 21 through mid-2022, you had 3 to 5 million workers leave their jobs voluntarily every month. And when you looked at the data, they make more than 10 grand on average more than they did before. So this is, job quality is critical, not just because it's the right thing, but also because it's the smart thing. And you'll hear this theme kind of over and over again, that the right thing and the smart thing and a lot of this work is the same thing. And we're beginning to see industry see that. We need government on the same page. We need our nonprofit partners all on that same page. So that's how I think about the questions that have to be solved. And you can begin to see, Michelle, to get to your original question, where people can begin to play. I'm going to mirror an old boss of mine, Jim Shelton, who I worked for a long time ago and who has been kind enough to still mentor me for the last 15 years. And he used to say, what is government really good at? Government is really good at creating rules and enforcing those rules with sticks and carrots. Very good. And it's good at getting things to scale through that formula. If you look at everything from desegregation to things like clean air regulations, they're really good at it. To a point of, like, they do it so well that you forget they're even rules and just what we do. What is the private sector really good at? It is good at moving very, very fast because it has to, because if it doesn't exist, and innovating in real time. What is it poor at? Time can be poor at looking long term because of the nature of its market. By the way, same thing, the opposite is true with the government. It can move really, really slow. What are nonprofits really good at, and social enterprise more broadly? They are generally closest to the people who have the problems. They have a, they, we would say in from a Silicon Valley perspective, they have great customer knowledge. Ideally, what you want is people doing their comparative advantage in pursuit of all these questions. And the challenge at times is, one, we don't collaborate across these sectors. And I've seen this now working in all of them. And then secondly, at times folks do things that they're not good at. And so, or they think that they can do it all by themselves. And so, I think the answer is there are people thinking about it, but I think we need to be more strategic, more collaborative, and people figuring out and sticking to what is my part. Let me do that really well and support others in their part.
You were talking about government, private, and nonprofit, and where they all come in together. And in my head, I was thinking, okay, because I too like Venn diagrams, like so, like the Venn diagram of that and the sweet spot. We're talking about how do we operate in the sweet spot, right? Because it's, well, that was the thing. Like, what does a sweet spot look like? And I think that's what you were referencing. So it was just kind of an observation.
I'll say just to your question on kind of what is that sweet spot, what does that good collaboration look like? I think it's one of those things like you know it when you see it because it can definitely look different in different issues in different places. I see a couple of things. I think one, the best examples that I see of that are actually more local than national. That's one. I think two, there's deep trust between those stakeholders. Part of the reason that times people don't work together is that I don't trust you. I don't trust you to do your job. I don't trust you to do what you told, what you said you were going to do. I think lastly, when I say collaboration, I always say collaboration to the point of discomfort. You need a group of people who talk so often, that I talk to you more than I talk to my spouse, because only when you get to that level of coordination do you begin to get the type of collaboration that you need to see. I think about, during in my home state of Maryland, during the deepest parts of the pandemic, when you talk about just vaccine rollout, or when you're talking about trying to help folks, and you began to see that. You see this in places, I think about in the Twin Cities, where you see actually really amazing kind of corporate, philanthropic, and kind of government collaboration on a number of issues, from workforce development to transportation to education. It's never perfect. Lots more that can be done, but it's the one I always think is more local than national. Two, deep trust. And then third, collaboration is the point of discomfort. Like you all have to talk so often that everyone knows what everyone knows.
And so so here's, and again, and this comes, from a place, if I'm being honest, of distrust about the world today, right? If I'm in building that kind of sweet spot in that Venn diagram of government, private, nonprofit, there's so, I mean, that's like it's a nice thing to say and where we want to go. And again, I mean, it's we have these conversations and they're not necessarily clinical, but like the devil is in the details of it, right? And so what does that mean? What does that look like? Where do we need to have our heads? Where do we need to be moving forward, particularly with a changing administration? Where we how do we craft that? What does that look like? What should we be thinking about? What questions should we be asking? Who should we be in, like where do we dive in?
Not an easy question. And so here's one thing that a couple of, again, like tenets, things that like I see when we're kind of moving in the right direction. One, employers have to be part of this. There is no way to do this without employers for a couple of reasons. One, they have the jobs. Two, they have the capital. Without their capital, without their jobs, this thing doesn't run. And so when I will say, during some of my probably most unusual days in government, I would be in meetings around workforce development in certain places, and I would look and I would say, I'm sorry, where are the firms? Because in the end, without if you don't have firms, you're really just having a conversation. So that's number one. I'd say almost a 1A as a subset. The other folks around the table need to understand those economics, meaning not just the employers are there, but I understand how their business runs, so that as I'm proposing solutions, I am satisfying those. That's just it just has to be the case. And when I think about the best workforce developers in the country, I think about my good friend Walter Simmons here in Prince George's County, where I'm from. I used to work with his mom at the Department of Labor. He understands this intuitively.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's not a nice to have, it's a need to have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What you see from the private sector side, one thing that I said to the private sector is workforce development is not like, it's not like ordering a pizza. Hey, I need this many workers with these skills, and I'm going to come back in 3 months and pick them up.
Right.
No, again, collaboration is to the point of discomfort. You have to be engaged in an act of co-creation with your workforce developers and government to make sure that these workers are prepared for the jobs that you need, that you have.
Yeah.
And then, and because you cannot say what you want, walk away, and then come back and say you didn't get what you asked for.
Yeah.
That's not, number one, it's not fair, and it's also just not smart.
Right.
And then, as an employer, once that talent is available, you need to make it easy for them to come into your firm and stay at your firm.
Yeah.
We see too often workers trained with the right skills, and what do? They just go back to HR. Well, if I went through this thing that you designed, why am I going back through the same HR path as everyone else? That doesn't make any sense. And then also, once they're there, how do you make sure that they're staying? One, because it's the right thing to do. But secondly, there aren't a bunch of workers to replace them on the back end because the American workforce is not growing.
Right. Yeah.
So it is in your interest to make sure that you retain them.
Yeah.
And then on the nonprofit piece, what I really, really think that they need to do more of and better, and again, you have lots of folks who are doing this work,
sure,
but it has to be at scale, is you have the customer knowledge. You know the workers that they're trying to reach. And what you need to do is relate. Let me tell you, same way that when I was in the private sector and we had to do customer journey maps to understand the customer that I was selling to,
Yeah. The
same thing for these workers that we're trying to bring in. Let me tell you about this community, these workers, and how you can best reach them to bring them into your firm.
Yeah.
Everyone's got to do something that's uncomfortable to make this work. And candidly, we're human beings. We don't like to do things that are uncomfortable or new, but we have to.
Yep.
And so, and again, it goes back to that trust, locality, the collaboration. But the alternative, I don't think any of us want to live.
Yeah. No, I mean, I appreciate what you're saying. And I mean, it resonates with what we do at the National Fund. I mean, so much of our work, I mean, we've worked with employers for years, and at times we've been told, like, oh, wait a minute, you're focusing on employers. What about workers? And it's just like, well, they go hand in hand. You can't do one without the other, but you also have to add in systems change, but you also have to add in the space to co-create so that people have an opportunity to have their voices heard. And so that's how, in tackling it based on what the needs are in the community. I mean, we have a huge childcare project happening in Baltimore right now. And really the thing that they're trying to do is build a coalition, a child coalition. And when you think how hard that work is, because at its core, what they need to do is a narrative change around how you even think about early childcare as a profession, and the early childcare educators, what they have to do and what we're tasking them with, right? These are our young babies that we're prepping them for the world, right? And so the work that happens around on the ground takes a lot. Right. And so I think this is one of the things we have when we talk about philanthropy and conversations we have with our investment partners, like what it means to dig in and stay in, and knowing that if this is where we're starting from, we're not going to get to the number, the quantitative number outcomes that you want in 2 years. Right. Like that's not going to happen. Right. That might look good for your board and your reports, because this is deep work that needs to be done. So we're really grateful that our investment partners are willing to go there with us. Like, yeah, we get where you're going with this. And that you're trying these things out. And I think what it allows us to do is not necessarily try and scale in our work at the National Fund, but to create a model that is scalable.
This is so important. And again, I say this as someone who's worked at a local level, state level, and federal level of government. Policy is a lagging indicator.
Yeah.
Systems level change is a lagging indicator. And generally, when I think about the policies that I've seen that have been the most impactful, what they usually are is some policymaker saw a thing somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I'll use an example. I remember during the Obama administration, all the promise communities work. That came from folks from the Obama administration seeing what Jeffrey Canada was doing in the Harlem Children's Zone. Kwame Owusu-Kessy, who's an old classmate of mine, is their CEO now and doing amazing work. But they saw that in Harlem and said, we need that everywhere. This kind of cradle to career kind of airtight system.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing. I think, for example, very few nonprofits can get to scale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In and of themselves. It happens, but it is rare.
Right.
What nonprofits are usually very good at is, can I create exactly as you said, a model in a place that works, that is sustainable, that if we're to be plugged into a system, actually could make huge change.
Yes.
But what that means is, and you all, the National Fund, do this so well, how do you make sure that the policymakers, and again, as someone who was one, I used to always talk about this, being at the federal level and being a policymaker, it's like being in a submarine. You are in a submarine running this really, really fancy thing, and up on the surface, you know stuff is happening. Mm-hmm. And you kind of have to take it up to the surface, look around, and you go back down. It is the distance between a policymaker and what's happening on the ground is so wide.
Yeah.
It's so wide.
Yeah.
So you all as nonprofits have to shorten the distance, make it easy, bring them. You know, when you go see a member of Congress, more than funding, more than anything else, ask them to come see what you're doing. That will lead to everything else. Same thing when I worked for the secretary, same thing. My best days were when I went out to the field and saw things.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. True. I could talk to you forever, TK, but I do want to get to AI, and then I have some rapid fire questions that I want to close out with. But I want to, again, I'm looking at time. I was like, oh, I have more questions. But we could always talk later. AI, we had a conversation. It was a year ago. I was in Seattle, and I said, I made a comment about how there was a robot coffee shop, and her name was Amanda, and there was one person working there, and her job during the time that I was there getting my coffee was to replace the hazelnut syrup for Amanda because she had run out of syrup. Otherwise, she was reading a book, right? And so when you think about AI and what's, I mean, it's here, it's been here, and we're moving forward. But my thought coming out of that, and you gave me a slightly different take, but my thought coming out of that was like, oh, wow, you know, what does this mean for workforce? So we can train folks to replace the syrup, or we can train folks to replace Amanda's robotic arm when it breaks down, or however, whatever happens on that. Right. And so from the equity standpoint, that's the equity challenge, right? In terms of how do we get people on the other side of that, but also how do we lift up the people who are, what do we do for the folks who are on either side of that, of Amanda, I guess is what I'm saying. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no. Look, I think, one, AI has actually been with us for a while. Again, yes. I was used a financial loan example. No human being has made a decision about whether you get a loan or not for probably 15 years.
Right.
That is the multivariate regression, which is, you know, early machine learning. The paradigm that I've used is, you know, historically in the private sector, we always say do more with less, meaning more revenue, usually incrementally more revenue with usually less people and less resources. Mm-hmm. What you need to move to is a paradigm of let's do a lot more with a lot more. That first a lot more is a lot more revenue, a lot more impact. And that second a lot more is this combination of people and AI. And by the way, a bunch of other emerging technologies that have not yet hit the peak that AI is going towards. And so we need to think about, as we talked about in the first place, if you look at the data, even if we hired all the people who were available to work, we still don't fill all the jobs.
Right.
We are going to have to think about how we use AI and other technologies to make every worker dramatically more productive. And by the way, American workers still are some of the most productive workers, if not the most productive workers in the world. But compared to the work that's coming, still not productive enough because of all the things that are going to need to be done. And so when I think about Amanda, you're right. Amanda's going to be on ideally both sides. Yes, repairing the machine arm if it breaks, also doing the syrup. But ideally, what this person is doing is, oh, shoot. Well, now that I'm not here necessarily giving people coffee, can I be out on the street getting people to come in the store?
Yeah.
Can I be walking up and down the street and saying, hey, by the way, we have a great coffee shop down there. So on and so forth. There are these other value add things. The analogy that I've used in past is I did an interview with a former journalist, and I said, you probably used to spend a lot of your time doing press releases, right? And she's like, yeah, like absolutely. I was like, in the ideal in the future, ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini writes the press release, and what you're doing is you're taking a source out to lunch.
Yeah.
You're meeting with an editor. All these other value add things that actually the machine can't do, at least yet. And so I think for me, some of the conversations that we're having around AI need to be cordoned off by time horizon. In the near term, it's a lot about how in the near term and the medium term, it's how do we have workers and machines get the best of each other so that we can get the best out of the economy. That is the task. In some ways, AI has surprised us. What we've seen, and we see this with autonomous vehicles, that AI and things that are powered by it right now are not good at replicating human motor function. They're not good at driving yet. That's why you don't see these cars on the road en masse. They're not good at construction yet, so on and so forth. What they're very good at, which means, by the way, things that we generally thought of as low wage or low skill, actually, I don't want to say are safe, but are actually not, that's not where folks are coming. Where folks are starting to feel stress is if you read and write for a living,
you're in trouble.
You are feeling stress you've never felt before, because generally, as these new technologies have come on, they've not come for those types of jobs. They've come for, frankly, things like I just described, where it was things that were routine that a human being did with the strength of their body.
Yeah,
this is different.
Yes, Mark Zuckerberg. So you say Mark Zuckerberg just talked about this and said that AI is replacing the mid-level managers, engineers, right? So to your point, right? That's.
I mean, it is. I mean, again, if you're a paralegal, if you're an accountant, if you do document review at a law firm, if you are kind of a front end, kind of, I don't say low level, but kind of early design software engineer. Again, for example, I was trying to make a website for something, and I normally would have hired a designer for that. Me and ChatGPT kind of hashed out a bunch of code in about 30 minutes that I was going to use for that website. As an example. You're hearing entrepreneurs saying, I used ChatGPT to make my logo. I would have paid a graphic designer for that, $4,000 or $5,000 to do that type of work. And so the bigger question is this. No one quite has the answer, but I believe in the near term, the challenge is going to be they're going to be workers, by the way, with the support of their communities, their countries, and their governments, who will move into different types of work, who will have to. And by the way, that work is going to be work in fields that are growing and that are in demand. And then figuring out how to use, by the way, all these technologies to help do that type of work. And the question is, what are the things required to make that happen? One is deep AI literacy. Van Jones talks about that this is a jump ball moment for equity in terms of AI, because everyone knows the exact same amount about AI right now, which is nothing. Yeah. And the question is, in 10 years, it won't be that way. In 10 years, we either can have a place where this actually was a leveler, where whether it be from the inner beltway of Prince George County, where I'm from, to East or West Baltimore, to Pine Ridge in South Dakota, where everyone knew how to use these technologies because we thought it was as fundamental as reading, writing, and arithmetic, or we're going to be in a place where we replicate the mistakes of the past, where, frankly, the folks who've always done well, no shame on them, are doing even better. Right. And the folks who have not done well are doing even worse.
Yeah, and I think what we need to do better, I mean, I think it is a jump ball moment, but it also requires access, right? And so we are still dealing with access issues when you think about places, particularly like in Upper Maine or—
Of course, broadband access issues, yep.
All of those things, right? Where students are still going to McDonald's to load up their papers, right? Because they don't have internet access, right? In rural areas and in all parts of the country, not just rural. I mean, yeah. So it is, but those are, I mean, to your point, there's so much work to be done. There's room for everybody to kind of hop in and move the ball forward on this.
I think that's exactly right. I spent 3 years of my life leading an organization focused on the expansion of broadband access. We connected 500,000 people in 48 states in 3 years. It is the pandemic taught us that we used to say, oh yeah, if you don't have internet, you don't have healthcare, you don't have education, you don't have work. And people kind of in 2015 thought that was just cute until the pandemic happened, and we all saw it. We all lived it. And so you're right, there are these prerequisites. And again, this might say it's a whole of society moment. You know, folks who are workforce developers, you can try and solve the broadband issue yourself, or I can introduce you to a ton of folks who have been working in digital equity for the last 15 years. How do you make them your partners? I think one thing that particular, as someone who was a nonprofit CEO, at times we do it all ourselves. And it's a mistake. We've got to figure out, what do I do really well? And who's someone out there is doing this other thing I need really well? And how do I bring them into my coalition? And that just has to be the reflex going forward, because the problems are too big and the people need help and they can't afford for us to be siloed.
Yeah. I remember a few years ago when we did the Advancing Workforce Equity and we were in Chicago doing it, and we had these equity work groups. And that was one of the things that I really appreciated about the way the Chicago team structured that equity team and finding their niche. They're like, wait a minute, we have lots of people in this space. Our first task is to see who's doing what and what's left and where do we hop in on that, right? In terms of how do you find your lane in this space too. I want to move to some rapid fire questions as we wrap up here. Okay, so this is just some one or two word answer when you think about this. So what's one skill you wish you had developed early in your career and why?
Hmm. Oh, this is a good one. The answer I would have said is wisdom.
Okay.
And let me just define wisdom. And I think it was Jim Shelton who maybe told this to me. He said, the definition of wisdom is knowing when to be patient and when to be impatient.
That's good.
I am by nature impatient.
Yes.
I was not good at the patience part, but I would say wisdom defined that way.
Okay. What's the best career advice you've ever received that most people don't follow?
I was told after the age of like 30, spend your time doing what you're good at. Mm-hmm. You still have weaknesses. Likely you'll always have them. Mitigate them. And the best way to mitigate those weaknesses is to get people on your team who are strong in those things in which you are weak.
Nice. So looking ahead 5 years, what's one ability or mindset you think workers absolutely need to develop now? Mindset.
It's an old one, but it's a true one. Learning to learn, which is every worker should sit and say, if I had to learn an entirely new skill set tomorrow, how would I do that? You know, I just got a thing on LinkedIn, which was a bunch of prompts that you can use for ChatGPT to teach you something.
Yeah.
Which is really just one set of it. But if I had to learn a new set of skills tomorrow, how would I do that?
Yeah. Yeah. What's one commonly held belief about career development that you think needs to be reconsidered?
These are good questions. One, that it is static. Again, you know, we will learn across our entire career. And then secondly, that all of the learning is book learning. When we think about like soft skills, durable skills, 21st century skills, by the way, the skills that most employers say are the most important, you don't learn them in a classroom. It's only possible to learn them in the act of doing, usually with a really great coach or mentor who kind of helps you get better along the way. I kind of say those types of skills, it's like being an athlete. You don't read a book on how to do a jump shot or throw a football or hit a baseball. You do it. Usually in practice first, you suck the first time, someone coaches you, you get better and better, then you do it a game, you don't do it as well as you did in practice. And that practice, that act of doing with a caring and compassionate and wise mentor is where how people get to competence and get to greatness.
And in full disclosure, I asked an AI system, I said, I'm talking to TK Ogg, what are 5 rapid fire questions I could ask him? And they said, here's what you asked, TK. So shout out to AI because they gave you some really great questions.
Oh, wow. I did not know that that's where they came from. Oh, wow.
Those rapid fire, yeah.
Those were really good. I'm going to steal some of those.
Yes, yes, you should. Great. Fantastic. So, thank you for playing that with us, TK.
Absolutely.
Was trying it out, and it was good. I appreciate your time today, and I look forward to working with you and seeing what you do in the future as we move.
Thank you so much again for what you do for the space, and however I can be helpful. And again, this is a partnership, and so thank you so much for what you do.
All right. Be well.
Absolutely. Be well.
State of a Workforce is a production of the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. This episode was produced by Josh Enoch. The music in this episode is produced by Alex Productions. You can find past episodes of State of Our Workforce on our website at www.nationalfund.org. To stay updated on State of Our Workforce and all things workforce development, be sure to follow the National Fund for Workforce Solutions on LinkedIn.
Don't forget to subscribe to our State of Our Workforce wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. We appreciate you tuning in and look forward to bringing you more valuable conversations in the future. Remember, everybody, life is tricky, so stay in your magic.